Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. College costs have been climbing much faster than the cost of living for a number of years. Combine that with a more recent decline in public support for state and regional colleges and the resultant reliance on tuition to make up that support, plus a ready supply of financing through student loans, it's easy to see why today student loan debt is rising by $100 billion a year. The total student loan debt obligation now exceeds $1 trillion and expected to hit $2 trillion by 2020. And more interestingly, more than a third of loans are delinquent. For over a decade, economists have debated the effects of the student debt burden, how it affects the economy, as well as the debtors themselves and their life decisions. So how do we get here? Well, my guest today tries to answer that question. Eric Best is a former banker, a quantitative researcher, and a professor of emergency management at Jacksonville State. He and his father, sociologist Joel Best, have written the book, The Student Loan Mess, How Good Intentions Created a $1 trillion Problem. It's published by the University of California Press. In it, they outline the evolution of government help in financing college and offer their solutions on how to minimize the burden of student debt, as well as needed reforms in administering student loan programs. Eric Best joins us today by phone. Eric Best, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
In your book, The Student Loan Mess, you describe the series of steps and messes that the government has done in providing student loan help over the course of the last century. But first, before we talk about those series of mess, give us a sense of how big is the student loan obligation on the U.S. economy?
At this time, actually last year, we crossed the $1 trillion boundary for federal direct loans. So we now have a total outstanding student loan obligations in excess of $1 trillion. So this is becoming a large debt obligation, smaller than mortgages and things like that, but now very formidable as its own category.
So in comparison to the meltdown in 2008, you were looking at what, I think $3 to $4 or $5 trillion, something like that?
Yeah, total student loan balances still pale in comparison to mortgages. But when you think about how common a mortgage is and how large the average balance is versus the relative rarity of a college education and those balances, it makes sense.
What are the repayment rates looking like right now out of that $1 trillion of loan obligations?
So the way repayment works for student loans this year, and this gets changed constantly, is that the rate is a variable rate, which right now is quite low because market interest rates are quite low. So a student in college right now is looking at a pretty gentle repayment, but if the economy starts heating up again and rates pop up in a couple years based on the rules that we have, students could look at long-term fixed loans in 8, 9, 10% range.
Now, what about the repayment rate? How many are in delinquent? How many are behind? How many have had their terms altered? Is it a pretty big percentage, or
it is a massive percentage?
Because you know the mortgage thing was 10, 15, 20%.
Yes, so this is one of the things that we often talk about. At the height of the financial crisis, the delinquency rate for mortgages was about 10%. Which meant that 9 out of 10 people were still paying their loans on time. For student loans right now, less than half of students are actually in repayment for loans. Now, it becomes a little murkier about what exactly that means, because there's different ways that you could stay out of repayment. You could be defaulting, you could claim hardship, you could be in graduate school, so on and so forth. But right now, according to Federal Reserve studies, only about half of students that should be repaying loans are. And so if we consider that, for one reason or another, one in two is at least temporarily not repaying loans, you can start seeing why this is a problem.
Yeah. And now, private industry is really out of the loan business today, aren't they?
They keep finding ways to get back in.
Basically, the government has always been, through about the last 20 years, the government was guaranteeing against a default on student loans in private industry.
Yes.
And that has been taken back by the government, because government is providing all the liability but receiving none of the benefits. And you also had some fairly usury-like interest rates at times.
Yes.
So those loans have come back, for the most part, back to direct government loans.
They have, although their student loans are still used extensively for securitization of other assets. And then also, when you graduate, your student loan is then sent to a servicer, which is almost always a private company. And so a lot of those businesses that used to make federally guaranteed loans are now servicing the federal direct loans. So all of the names we're familiar with are still around.
Really interesting. Your book begins by describing a series of steps, and as you refer to it in the book, in the student loan messes that have occurred through the history of the U.S. student loan history. How did we get here?
We decided to write this book when my father, Joel, and I realized that we had been talking about student loans for about 10 years, basically from the time when I was an undergraduate through when I went to work at a bank through graduate school. And we realized that while the environment about student loans was changing, the narrative was actually fairly constant over a decade. And so we decided to start looking backwards and see what the historical narrative was about student loans. And what we found is that at the dawn of student loans in the late 50s, the narrative was all about, you know, competing with Russia and the Cold War. And so originally we had student grant and loan programs designed to improve our defensive capabilities. And so that first set of student loan policies was designed to prevent what we call wasted brain power, meaning people that could have benefited from college that decided not to go based on a variety of circumstances. And so we had years and years of policy that encouraged more and more enrollment. And that turned into, in the 70s, concern about deadbeat students that for one reason or another weren't paying back their loans. And that evolved in about the 90s into concern about crushing debt, because now balances were getting, at that time, very serious for student loans, even though we would almost laugh at how small they are today.
And so this has been building, and you've had a series of steps in which the government has kind of waffled back and forth on whether it wants students to actually provide for the cost of their education through loans and repayment of loans and direct grants. Because in the late 1970s, you had things like the Pell Grant come along, which was really more about helping low-income students actually go to college not in debt, but providing the money to get them to college.
Yes, you're absolutely correct. And the best way to answer to this is to talk about the changing purpose, or at least changing use of student loans.
Let's even take it back a step further, because you actually detail the story of the GI loans.
Yes.
The GI loan, that turned out to be an incredibly popular program, wildly more popular than even the most optimistic estimates. Were people surprised by how popular the GI loans were?
They were. And if you go back to World War II and you look at the proportion of people that were getting a college education, the numbers are almost impossibly small to imagine today. So you had a very, very small percentage of the population that was actually going to college. And so you could imagine that there was probably much more demand for college than there was opportunity to go. So, you know, when we started the GI program, the Thanks of a Grateful Nation, and giving people a really great deal to go get an education, there was a huge amount of demand for it.
And out of that, and of course, once Sputnik came, and all of a sudden we were worried about the brain game between Russia and the Soviet Union and the United States. Then you had the National Defense Education Act, which was really science and math-based, and for teachers, too.
Yes.
Were there a lot of stringent conditions on that first loan program?
There were, and that is something that would be considered almost impossible to pass today. But original loan and grant programs were based on major and institution and student. And so over time, over the decades, we've taken all of those restrictions away. So you can now get a student loan for any major you want at any institution you want. So we had what were originally very targeted STEM programs that have turned into completely general education programs over time.
And when did that occur? In the 60s or in the 70s or when exactly?
By the end of the 60s, things were very different than the original Defense Act. These were all little policies that occurred at one time. This is one reason why we categorize things into messes, because there aren't really a lot of single moments where these things happen. You start having very, very little policy changes that evolve over time.
Now, you mentioned congressional concerns over deadbeat students not paying back loans, people defaulting on their loans. Has government's response in general helped the mess or aggravated it?
That's a hard question to answer. And if you think about the entire history of student loans, what we did is we originally developed a student loan program that was all about access. And so we made sure that a whole bunch of people could get access to college loans. And then after we did that and we started worrying about repayment, we made student loan policy all about making sure that the government could collect that money. So we made the rules that, you know, make sure people can't discharge student loan debt in bankruptcy and things like that. And so today, with the combination of the historical access policy and then the very restrictive repayment standards, we have a set of policies from the government that allows almost anyone to borrow some money to give college a try, and it makes it almost impossible to discharge it. And so it's not necessarily the fault of the government. It just creates a situation where a lot of young people can get in a lot of debt and, you know, arguably not really know what they're doing.
And one of the things that you document, and you kind of beat up a little bit on proprietary colleges, but, you know, a lot of times when we think about student loans, we think about 2 or 4 year public institutions, either state or regional state institutions or private institutions. Mm-hmm. But, of course, the student loan business is open for any sort of post-secondary, proprietary, for-profit universities, vocational training. And there you see default rates or actually the success, the student success is far more limited where, you know, out of 10 students, maybe half or more don't finish and taking out loans while they're in school.
Yes, and so I, you know, as you can tell from reading the book, we're not fans of for-profit general education universities. I do want to say that I don't think there's anything inherently wrong with the model, but I do think that incorporating as a for-profit education company makes it very difficult to service students well. And so you see a lot of schools that happen to be for-profit kind of innovating as far as bad behavior in education. And I think, unfortunately, a lot of nonprofit schools actually watch a lot of things that for-profit institutions are doing and start copying them. But our problem with for-profit schools is that at this point, they have now more or less tapped the domestic student market in the United States, and so they can't grow anymore. And what's happening, we're seeing this with a set of schools called Corinthian right now, is that they're now failing, and this is going to result in astronomical write-offs for the government, because the government has a deal with student loans where if your school closes, you can have your loans discharged.
Wow.
And so some of these schools are now so big that the Department of Education really couldn't afford to excuse all those loans.
Now, it's interesting, since the Department of Education is taking these loans back in, when you look at the balance sheets right now, the Education Department looks like it's like the most successful part of government. I mean, making billions of dollars. And what I was surprised to know that a lot of that money is not real money. It's perhaps loans that are delinquent, that are not being paid, being treated as assets because of the change in law in which student loans can't be discharged even through bankruptcy.
Right, and so this is somewhere where we enrage a lot of accountants because, according to GAAP, which is generally accepted accounting principles, loans always are assets. However, what the government is able to do is they're able to claim that they're going to get back 100% of that money, which is something that normal businesses are not able to do. They have to account for write-offs and you know, things like that. And so if you say that 100% of this money is going to be paid back, the balance sheet looks really great. But then if you go look at the actual repayment statistics and you see that 1 in 2 people that should be repaying isn't for one reason or another, you start to understand that things aren't as rosy as they look.
And you include some case studies in the book in which I think it was a Caltech student and he had pretty tough debt where he was like about, 10 to 20% of his take home was going to service his debts. He left his job to find a better job, and about that time the economy turned south. Mm-hmm. And at that point, he's watching this balance continue to sail upwards. And it seems like, you know, now the amount he has to repay dwarfs what he actually originally took out in loans.
Oh, it does. And in cases like that, the odds that those loans are going to be paid back completely are very low.
Well, what's the answer for things like that? Where I can see where students, you know, former students are thinking about walking away, but there's really no way to walk away. What happens when they go into default?
The very worst thing that can happen, and I haven't been able to find a lot of cases of this actually happening, but the worst it can get is actually wage garnishment, where your student loan payments are just taken out of any wage income, like another tax.
Hmm. My guest today is Eric Best, Assistant Professor of Emergency Management at Jacksonville State University. He and his father, Joel Best, who's a professor of sociology at the University of Delaware, wrote The Student Loan Mess, How Good Intentions Created a Trillion-Dollar Problem. It's published by the University of California Press. As I mentioned earlier in the book, you sort of outline the sort of history of student loan activity in the United States. And then at about 1980, economist Stephen Deutsch talked about the student loan programs. He said this whole, that's really when the student loan thing really started opening up. And he said, this is going to encourage students to choose schooling over other activities, to select higher cost schooling options because easy access to money. It's going to encourage parents to reduce their contributions to the schooling of their children. It's going to encourage institutions to increase their charges and reduce grant aid, and it's going to encourage governments to reduce grant aids and funding to higher ed. And boy, when you think about that, almost everything has happened over the last 35 years.
Yes, and he was a man with a very, very interesting history, but it almost looks like he had a crystal ball when it came to the macro effects of what was going to happen with student loans. And he's completely right. When we allow somebody to get access to money and repay it later, especially a young person that doesn't have a lot of experience with debt, in a lot of ways that's going to throw caution out the window. And now instead of looking at the way to spend the next 4 years of your life based on price, you're going to look at where to spend the next 4 years of your life based on where it is and how nice it is and so on and so forth. And so the idea that you could have access to student loans independent of where you go really changed the way that students choose where to get an education.
I was really interested in the idea that institutions are going to increase their charges. And that's the one thing you've seen over the last 35 years is all areas of higher institutions of education have increased their tuition and their cost far exceeding inflation over the last 35 years.
They have, and it's understandable because when you're at a state house and you're thinking about how much money to give to a higher education institution, and overnight you suddenly have the ability to charge students more and allow them to afford it, it becomes very tempting for states to reduce appropriations. And I looked up the data for Oklahoma before I came on today, but in Oklahoma, even in the last 5 years, state funding for higher education has fallen about 11%. And what you see is that 10 years ago in the state, tuition was paying for about 25% of the cost of a public education. 5 years ago, it was paying for 31.5%. And today, it's paying for over 42%. And so what you see is you see states, and all of them, this isn't a unique thing in Oklahoma, but you see states reducing appropriation and then increasing the percentage of revenue that comes from tuition.
Which is really interesting because those state institutions were created, many of them back in the Morrill Act. It was about providing opportunity for those state citizens to enable to move the state ahead.
Right, and I think the way that they would answer that they're still providing that opportunity is if you start looking at out-of-state tuition compared to in-state, your eyes will pop out of your head.
Right. Well, through the course of the book, The Student Loan Mess, you outline the problem, then you offer some solutions, which really comes back down to some things. I think the barn door is already open and the horses have left the barn, but it's about reducing the actual cost of school. And some are very interesting in the case of state schools. Is there any sort of belief that states maybe should start picking up more of the higher education cost within their state?
You start seeing some saber rattling about that in the financial crisis. And I think one of the anecdotal reasons for that is that when the economy went bad, a lot more people were suddenly interested in education. And so there was a new lens on what was going on in higher ed. But what we say in the book, what's really the thesis of our last chapter, is that if you aren't controlling costs, you might as well not bother with anything else. And what we mean by that is that if you look at student loan policy, we're talking about, you know, modifying interest rates, we're talking about modifying repayment periods, we're talking about modifying all kinds of different things except cost. And so what a lot of policy now is doing, and one of the reasons is that the federal government cannot dictate what state universities do. So they, you know, the federal government can't just change all this overnight. But what they try and do is they try and make repayment easier because they actually can't dictate costs. And so what we need, whether or not it's going to happen, is we need state appropriations to start going back up in order to get student loan balances down.
Now, how do you control costs on a variety of state and private institutions to make it more affordable? Because, as you well know, even in a private university where the cost, and a lot of state universities too, where the cost is, say, X, the student might be paying X minus 40%. I mean, the university is actually receiving X minus 40%, X minus 60%, maybe even X minus 70%. The actual money they receive from that student's tuition through grants and scholarships and the things are much lower than the actual cost. Is it possible to take all that sort of wiggle room out?
It is, and there are actually a couple of private colleges that have tried to do that, where they've just come out and announced that, you know, instead of calling our tuition $45,000 now and discounting it for everybody, we're calling it $20,000 and we're not offering discounts anymore. And interestingly, it turns out that students really don't like that model. I think we've almost become used to the high tuition, high discounting model.
Well, the scholarship is almost like, it's like an achievement.
Yes. Right. It's an award you can put on a resume.
Mm-hmm. Well, what are some of the other ideas that you have for solving this high cost of student loans that really are affecting this generation, the last generation of students?
What we were hoping to do for future students is just inspire a conversation about how, you know, we have to have an honest talk with ourselves about controlling costs. For past students, for students that are already in repayment, the answer is a little more complicated because we're making loan programs such as income-based repayment and pay-as-you-earn that have increasingly generous repayment terms. And while that's helpful for former students, it's almost a moral hazard problem for current and future students who are looking and saying, oh, you know, these former students aren't having to repay their whole balance, so I might as well go take out more loans. And so there's almost nothing that you can do that will help both future and former students. It becomes a very difficult dance to try and help past students without making bad incentives for future ones.
You know, the other part of this issue, and you allude to this in the book, is that student loan debt is very incredibly unevenly distributed. Even the average is pretty misleading because you have, you know, elite private university loan balances versus state versus even regional state colleges. It's two different universes.
Yes, and it spreads out even more than that, because on one end you might have somebody that tried one semester at college, and on the other hand you have somebody that borrowed for undergraduate college and medical school. Mm-hmm. And so if you just look at the average of, you know, those two hypothetical students, you get a very bad picture about what's going on.
What is the effect on the student as far as the average student that takes loans out to finance their education? What's the drain on their earning power down the road?
That's being duked out in public policy circles quite a bit right now, where you see the American Enterprise Institute and the New America Foundation and a couple other organizations just constantly releasing studies showing that those with debt are actually doing better than others, those with debt are doing worse than others. And the unfortunate answer is it's very difficult to get an accurate picture of what's going on. And one of the reasons is that the Department of Education, and they're forced to, it's not that they're just being a bad actor, but they're really not able to release a lot of personal data about what's going on with student loans. And so the answer, unfortunately, is it's complicated.
Well, what's your best advice for people who are getting ready to send a child to college, a person thinking about going back to school? What are your best advice to minimize the amount of loans available and, you know, take advantage of some of these new programs in which, you know, if you enter certain fields, you can have a lot of your loans repaid? Do you see that as a, for example, do you see that as a future trend in which we get back to that idea of the STEM loans where, you know, if you go into certain fields, those loans will be taken care of?
There's certainly a lot of talk about doing that. It would be very interesting to see that happen and kind of see the set of policy go full circle. But I think that what's more likely to happen is that we're going to reduce the growth in loan limits, making it less attractive for colleges to continue to increase prices. And regarding somebody going to school today, my advice would be to sit down and have an honest conversation with yourself about what you want to get out of college, and then find the cheaper places where you can get that. You know, a lot of times students don't want to go to the local school or the state school, and that's certainly understandable, but odds are you're still going to get a very good education doing that at a much cheaper price. And it, you know, it's difficult to have a conversation with an 18-year-old talking about how something is going to be more expensive down the road, because somebody that's been a dependent the whole time might not understand what down the road means.
Well, the name of the book is The Student Loan Mess: How Good Intentions Created a Trillion-Dollar Problem. Let me ask you, did you talk to economists that see this as the next bubble?
Yes, and bubble's not really an appropriate word for this. I know we had a chapter about the for-profit bubble, and what I always want to make sure to do is clarifying is that's a bubble about number of students, not necessarily about costs. And so some of the proprietary schools have business models that relied on continued growth, and they've actually grown so large that there aren't really any more United States students to market to. And so that was the bubble in education. Other than that, it's kind of hard to have a bubble in higher education, because a degree is not something that you can directly go and sell. You know, arguably, you get a degree and then you sell your services as labor, but you can't transfer that degree to somebody else. Where you know, by contrast, a home is something that you can sell as it continues to pop in price. If loans continue to be defaulted on, then the program is going to get more and more restrictive, and that's going to cause a big problem for American colleges and universities. And I know we were talking earlier about Christensen at Harvard that was saying that half of all schools will be gone in the next 15 years. And I think that claim is possible if, for some reason, federal student loan programs went away.
Well, it's a really interesting book, The Student Loan Mess. Eric Bess, thanks very much for joining us.
Oh, thank you so much for having us.
Eric Bess is a quantitative researcher and a professor of emergency management at Jacksonville State University. He and his father, sociologist Joel Bess, are the authors of The Student Loan Mess: How Good Intentions Created a Trillion-Dollar Problem. It's published by the University of California Press. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. If you missed one of our recent programs, they're available online anytime at publicradiotulsa.org. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.